session number 20373, reel 3.
But that was reel 3.
As most people know, and I certainly know, that in the commandos, you're always with a good pal or another lad that you're soldiers with, and you know each other's sort of strengths and weaknesses, and you know how to cope with each other. But when we came under sniper fire and this 88 and mortar fire, a fighting patrol was we decided to send a fighting patrol out, and it was a case of you, and I was one of the yous, unfortunately. And the patrol consisted of Lieutenant Williams, Sergeant Port, Corporal Underwood, myself, and Private Mills, or Guardsman Mills, because he was only 19 and he was a Grenadier Guards boy, and a fine young man, grand lad. And we're just crossing this bombed area, going towards a hedgerow, and we come under heavy fire. We're down in this bomb crater. The fire slackens and we start off again, and we're coming, this Corporal Underwood is about 15 yards in front of me. I'm to the left of him. Mills is to the right of him. Williams and Porter well over to the left somewhere. I never even saw those, and they were supposed to be leading us, but anyway, that's beside the point. And believe me or believe me not, and I felt it at the time, and I feel it very strongly today, that Corporal Underwood, who had been in action in Sicily, Italy, most probably Dieppe as well, I don't know, I couldn't say, but most probably Dieppe as well, couple of landings, go straight for a gap in the hedgerow, and down he goes, sniper, dead, bump, gone. And I thought, laddie, that's a silly thing to do. So by this time, Mills and I are in one crater, and over to our left, a white flag goes up, and the Germans with the Espando shot it to pieces. Brr. So I thought there and then, Bert Beddoes, you're on your own. So I had to take command of myself, and I said to Mills, I'm keeping my rifle, I'm keeping my bandolier, and I'm going to make for that hedgerow. And we'll never make it with our big packs on. We were carrying about 80, 90 pounds in these packs. And when I tell you, everything I loved was in my wallet, my photographs of my family, Doreen, who became my wife, everything, my food, everything was in there. But I thought, boy, your life comes first. You've got to get in that hedgerow and you've got to get back to your unit. And you're taught in the army to run about 5-10 yards under fire and down, but I'm up and I run about 20 and dive through this hedgerow, and when I pull myself together, I'm cut and to pieces with this hawthorn hedge, but I'm down below. I'll never forget, just through the hedgerow there's a little dip, and you've all seen cowboy films when the shooting and spurts of sand come up. I can still see that today, and it just clipped the top of this bank, so they were just about 2 seconds late with the firing, else they'd have got me. Now Mills stayed in the crater, he made a run, and on his next run they riddled him, because I saw that and he'd gone. Now I'm lying in this hedgerow frothing at the mouth, and I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, and and another frightening thing, on this field there were canisters with the antennae of the anti-personnel line, and I thought, well, I've got to be careful where I crawl, or these will be all over the place. And I was going to wait till it was dark and crawl away, but the Jerrys knew where I was, and they come along shooting in this hedgerow, throwing these bombs in, and I thought, well, I've no bloody chance if I stay here. And I just stood up And I mean, okay, I gave myself up. It's nothing to be proud of, and it's nothing really to be ashamed of. But I knew I was going to die, and there's nothing I could have done because I'm in this place. I couldn't see these guys. I knew that anyway. There were about 20 of them there. So that they gave me a belt when they got me. And when I got round to where the Germans had taken these prisoners, there was Lieutenant Williams and Sergeant Port. And Williams said, "I thought you'd got away, Beddoes." And I said, "Well, I won't say what I said, but I said I thought you had as well. But obviously you haven't." And from then, my troubles really started.
You said they gave you a belt?
Oh, yeah. Well, I couldn't speak German. But the first thing they do, I had no watch to take, but I had a fountain pen. If you're a troop clerk, you need a pen. So they took, and I just said mine. Well, it's the same word, and this big German gave me a belt across the ear, all floored me. But I thought, well, it's no use arguing about a pen, so I put up with that. And then I was put into this dark place, and other lads were in, wounded. Joe Dunn, who was a mate of mine, he'd got severely wounded in the groin. He died either that night or the next day. And then we are sent off with Williams and Sergeant Port, one or two paratroopers, and we're sent to Cobourg.
Which day were you captured?
D plus one. That's all I had. But I perhaps saw in a lot of action in 2 days. But I would have liked to carry on, but there was nothing really I could do. I've thought about it and I've thought about it, and I don't know. It upsets me from time to time, but there was nothing I could do. And I'd read that if you're captured, the best time to escape, and I tried like at night, but we're all secure. And anyway, I was there, and we got to Cobourg.
How far away from La Ville Battery were you when you were captured?
Oh, it's only about 600 or 700 yards, but we're right. We went towards the German lines instead of going the other way. And during this time, I'm remembering. While I'm lying doggo, I'm expecting our laddies to counterattack. That's what I was expecting, but it never happened. And what had happened, after we'd been sent on this patrol, they'd consolidated again just a little bit some other place. And the Jerry's counterattacked, and I can hear them coming in screaming and shouting. And also they'd been heavily mortared or shelled. And there were these craters, when I tell you, some of them were 10 or 12 yards across or diameter. And there was a lot of commandos, four troop commandos in one of the, and I believe a shell landed right in the middle, so they got severely battered, no question about it, for no point really, and they withdrew, and eventually they got back to Amfreville, and of Lieutenant Pollard's section, who I was with, the 8 men got back out of 23, and there was only me and Mills out of that, of his section, who were prisoners. So the others got a mauling, didn't they? And that was the end of Merville. In fact, it was said many years later by our Colonel Young, who'd come so far with us. He was asked about going to Merville, and you know what his answer was? "No, I don't go to Merville. There are ghosts there. There are ghosts at Merville." And everyone, like the 9th Para, our 4 and 5 troops of 3 Commando, all got hammered at Merville. And basically all that was there were these, well, as regards modern artillery, they were small guns, First World War quality stuff. And I read about, well, I've got a tape of how the resistance We had the information what size guns were in this gun battery and that gun battery, but they certainly didn't get it right at about Merville. It was just a sad, poor affair all round. Through nobody's fault, nobody can be blamed. It was just one of those things. Anyway, now I'm a prisoner with these other guys, and we're taken in the morning pushing a handcart. What was on the handcart? Perhaps wounded, I can't recall. Perhaps wounded on the handcart, and we stopped at the first place. Was like a, it was disguised as a farm. It was a concrete strong point. And I'll never forget, Abrams was with us by this time, and his arm severely wounded, and he's told to get his arms up. We got another crack for trying to tell the Germans he's badly wounded and couldn't hold his arm up and all that. No food, never had a drink, no food, no nothing. And then eventually we get to a place short of Cobourg, I think, and we're thrown in this sort of, a little dungeon type place. In fact, a friend wrote to me two or three years ago, and he described it similar to the Black Hole of Calcutta. No food again, and eventually we get to Pont-l'Evêque, and that would be on 10 days after D plus, no, 10 days after we were captured. And it was a school run by nuns, and we got off. I had my first bite of solid food in 10 days in that, and in that place. And from there we went to various places. We went from there, we were handcuffed by this time when we were taken to Versailles, Paris, Chartres, and all the time starving. And eventually we got into an interrogation centre at Chalon-sur-Marne, all put in little cells. By this time, weeks and weeks had gone by this time, and I'm down. Well, I couldn't stand up without sort of holding on to things, and if I got up quickly, I'd go into a whirl. And we were interrogated of what sort of boats we came on and what we didn't come on, and I thought, well, what sort of information that is? But we stuck to the, not just the rank, name and number, all that's a load of baloney. You've got to tell them a bit, you've got to kid them along. But we didn't give them any information. And eventually we get to a prisoner of war camp, and at Limburg, and we were all asked to write a letter. I think, I don't know, I can't remember the dates, but we, so some said, oh, I'm not writing a letter, they'll glean information. I said, well, what information can they glean? I said, no, I'm going to put nothing in it that they're going to glean any information. So I wrote, one or two others wrote, and my parents eventually got that letter 6 months after I was taken prisoner, and that was the first intimation they had of me being a prisoner. They were notified that I was missing, presumed killed. So you can imagine my girlfriend by that time, Doreen, and my mum and dad, they were upset for months and months and months. But Doreen, she always said, I knew you were alive. So whether she did or not, I don't know, but she always said she did. And she used to go and see my mum and dad every night, and when she got there they'd be in tears, and when she left they'd be happy, and the next night the tears again. So she did a wonderful job. And eventually we got to this place, Limburg, as I say, and I wrote this letter and it got through, so good job I did. And then we got sent to Mühlberg, and then I'm sent on a working party. I said I was a joiner again by this time. I thought I might get a cushy job. And I'm sent to a stone quarry. Blimey, that was hard work. But eventually I'm promoted to be the fireman on the engine, which meant stoking the boiler, cleaning the engine, running in front of it, letting go of the engine one way and the trucks the other, pulling points over. We had two or three nasty do's when all the trucks got crashed up, but and I was pulled over the coals for that. But that's what happened.
Were you sabotaging it?
In a way, yeah. Another little incident at that little camp. A Polish fella who was the driver of this train gave me a few onions. And I'm boiling them up in our little hut one night, and the sergeant major came in. He was a little, horrible little man, been on the Russian front, so perhaps you can understand him being horrible. He had the Russian medal on, and he wanted to know where I'd go, who's they were, and nobody spoke, so I had to admit in the end they were mine. Where did I get them? If they'd told him the Polish fella, he'd have been up for the high jump. So I just said a farm cart went through and these onions had were thrown off to me, and I picked them up, and that's how. He didn't believe me, but I got away with it, except for the fact that we used to have a shower on a Saturday, work 5 days a week, and Saturday morning, shower on Saturday afternoon, and my punishment was that I cleaned the engine out on a Sunday morning. And if anybody's cleaned the bars, the fire bars and the tubes of an engine, you know you're black again. So I was black for the rest of the week. And food was very short. And with being a joiner, then I was sent to a little factory that made fur gloves out of rabbit skins for the Russian front. And when I tell you I was there, and I helped a little man called Herb Retschneider, little man, wizened old man, and we used to have a bucket of tar. We used to heat the tar up, and we used to go on the roofs just repairing shrapnel damage. And I was there 2 or 3 months, and I don't think I did a day's work in all that time. I did run away one day. I got on the train, wrong train, but I got collared at 2 or 3 stations later, but I did make one effort. And then we set off from there, where the Russians were advancing, and we set off on the Great March.
From Mühlberg?
I've been sent from Mühlberg onto a working party to Naunov. The other place was Wurzen, W-U-R-W-E-N, and Naunov. All in Saxony, these places. And then what happened then? We're on the march, food was short, rations, we didn't know where we were going here, there and everywhere. And we start getting strafed by the RAF, which wasn't very pleasant. And then we decided, a few of us, that we weren't getting anywhere. We thought we might be shot any time, the group of us, there's quite a few of us. We decided to take the column over, horse-drawn wagon. It was my job to get a sergeant major. And at the signal, I asked him for his revolver, and he went that quick for it, I thought he was going to shoot me. But he couldn't get it off quick enough to give it to me. And he asked for his belt back, because it was his own property. And after we'd met the Yanks, I gave it to an American doctor. By this time I was in military hospital with whatever you call it, malnutrition or whatever, I don't know. Gastritis I had and everything. And they were tough days. And eventually we got back to England. I was in military hospital for a number of months. Then I was sent back. I did mention that I was in hospital in England, but let me tell you a little bit more about Germany. When we took this column over and finally found the Yankees, the first Yank we met was a Jeep with a Bren gun on, and of course the first thing the Americans give you is the Lucky Strike cigarettes. And although I was a smoker, it never worried me too much about not smoking. It was a great worry to a lot of prisoners. They'd even give a small ration of bread for a cigarette, but I would never do that. But some did. And I'm in heaven. We have something to eat when we get there. I'll never forget the Americans had thousands of German prisoners, and we were told if we wished we could go in and rob them of this, that and the other, but I didn't want to rob anybody of anything. I just wanted to get home. And then I'm taken poorly with this gastritis and what have you, and I'm put into this American hospital, and they were very kind. In the next bed to me was a little Gurkha. I can still see him now with his few little hairs on his face, and he was a smiling sort of guy, and I said he'd be happy to be going home, and he said he wasn't happy to go home, and I asked him why, and I'll never forget the words he said. He said, "There's always fightings, always fightings." So he said he didn't really want to go home. So whatever happened to him, I do not know.
What did he mean by there's
always fightings at home in his village, I suppose, or whatever. I don't know, but that's what he said. Always fightings. I'll never forget it. And
he meant there always was for him to take part in.
Pardon?
Perhaps he meant there were always other wars.
Oh, I could have possibly, if that's perhaps what he meant, he'd perhaps had enough of it. Anyway, we then go to a German aerodrome waiting for Dakotas to take us back. And it's full of adventure, this, really, because we eventually got on a Dakota after routing round the aerodrome, and there was tons of German army uniforms and badges and swastikas, but I never got anything. And we got on this plane, and we were flying over some, whether they were mountains or not, but there's a rat out. The war hadn't finished by this time, you know. It had another 2 or 3 weeks to go, I think. And there was a rat-a-tat, and I thought, so near, I thought we were being machine gunned, but it was hailstones on the skin of the plane. And we landed in Paris. What happened then? You'll never believe it. The undercarriage gave way, one wheel, and we swizzed round, but we all got out, no problems. But that wasn't very, very good either. And then we had a walk round Paris on that night. Can't remember much about it, except that we eventually found an American PX where they gave us a bite and a drink, I suppose. And then we got on another plane, a Dakota again, over the channel, and we landed at Banbury. Banbury, we're on a train, and we finish up in a military hospital in Wakefield. On that evening, I go out with an Australian soldier, and we had a few drinks, called in at a dance. Some people asked us in for some supper in Wakefield to the private home, and eventually we got back to the hospital rather late. Had a job to find our way into the hospital. We had to climb over a wall, but we found the ward eventually. And I'm getting ready to get into bed, and the Australian is packing his kit bag. So I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm not staying here. I'm going to the Australian Legation in London. And he packed his bag, and it must have been midnight or gone, and off he went. Whatever happened to him, I'll never know. But that was an Australian. I thought, well, typical. Good luck on you, Cobber. And off he went. And then I'm sent back to Southport on leave. By this time I've got American sort of uniform on. I don't know, they look like an American soldier or English. I had a bit of each on, American boots and trousers, I think. And got back, and then after my leave I'm in military hospital in Southport, which was quite nice. And then after a few months I'm back in the army. I'm sent on a down south somewhere, I can't remember the name, Donington, South Midlands, I think, Donington, an RAOC depot. Now, when you've been a fighting soldier, you don't fancy the ROC, you know. Anyway, I'm in the ROC by this time, and I'm sent on a wireless signals course, and I've still got my old paybook here, and I've passed with distinction. So then I'm sent to a little depot in Blackburn, at Oldham actually was the depot, and then I'm sent on a sub depot at Blackburn, which I could get the train home quite frequently. And I'm, by this time I've got a stripe up, I'm back on the promotion trail again, so I'm a Lance Corporal, and I used to go for the rations. I was appointed the QM of this little detachment, and we lived very, very well, I'll tell you, we did very nicely. And eventually I'm demobbed from the army, group 43. I'm demobbed on the 13th of November 1947 in York. And I had my civvy suit and my trilby hat and my shirt and my tie, and off I'm home to Southport. And I had a few weeks leave. Oh, got married. Had a bit of a honeymoon in the Lake District at Ambleside, and came back and to Southport and started work again for Broadbent as an upholsterer, although I'd been doing joinery and all sorts of things. Anyway, I worked for them for about 12 months. About 12 months, yes. And I decided the money wasn't very good. So there was a firm, a lot of the hotels in Southport had been taken over for war work and whatnot, and they were being put back to the owners as hotels, and we were refurbishing them, and then they were finished. So I thought, well, and I started in business on my own and furnishing and upholstery and carpets and whatnot, and I did that for 28 and a half years.
Did the war experience affect readjusting to civilian life?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was terrible. If my wife was here, she'd tell you now. Oh, I was ages. When I tell you, if I was anywhere for years and years and years, if it went dark and there was a threat of a thunderstorm, I was scared to death. It doesn't bother me one iota now. I'll go out into, but for years I could not face thunder. Miss tummy, I couldn't eat. Doreen would make me a meal. I'd say, I'm ready for something. She'd say, are you ready for your meal? I'd say, yes, I'm ready for my meal. And when she'd made it, I couldn't eat it. All things like that. And after the war, our war, there was no counselling, there was no help. Nobody wanted to know. And we just had to struggle through. But eventually, I made the grade. I've still have problems here now and then. But for years and years, you know, it upsets me from time to time. And, yeah, I've had two nervous breakdowns, but no more, thank goodness, no more. And how did I forget where I was up to then?
What opinion of the Germans did you
imprisonment? Well, the only nice German I met was this little nice man who used to carry the bucket of tar for while he repaired the shrapnel. As I said, his name was Herbrecht Schneider, and he used to go into a corner, rub his hand across his throat, and say, Hitler kaput. He didn't like it. He's the only one I ever met. I've been spit at by children, ill-treated by guards, starved, no kindness, except one little old guard at this stone quarry. He wasn't he used to play a violin, and I can recall it now, him playing in his old violin in his scratchy way. Silent night, one Christmas. Just little things like that. But, you know, I've read since about the Germans, and when you think about this man, Hitler, and his men, and how they were doctrinated, and what he did for them, and how great they were, and don't forget, They were winning for years, you know, and they honestly thought they were the greatest. And they were the greatest at one time, make no mistake about that. Unfortunately, they did it.